Hello and welcome to the 8th episode of Season 5 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Tuesday the 5th of June 2012, and in this episode we have been fueled by a barbecue inside that wasn't on a barbecue. To give us
That's a grill, isn't it? Well, what the Americans call a grill.
Yes.
No, Americans call a barbecue a grill, don't they?
I'm really confused now.
Don't know, but we're really full of feet.
To celebrate the Diamond Jubilee. We're also going to interview Elizabeth Crumback from the California Loco team, Ubuntu Women and the Community Council, and Charles Dr. Chuck Severance from the Dev8D conference that Mark attended. We will, of course, cover the latest news, events, bit about Ubuntu, command line love, and listen to another episode of Tomorrow's Technology Today from the archives. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on the website and in the IRC channel. I am Tony, and with me this week we have a full house of barbecue fueled Mark.
Hello.
Barbecue fueled Alan.
Hello.
And salad fueled Laura.
And barbecue.
Lies. Absolute lies.
Barbecue fueled Laura.
Very little salad being eaten.
There was
Laura has lots of sausage inside her.
Right. And chicken.
And chicken.
And burger. Right. Mark, what have you been doing since the last episode?
As you just mentioned, I went to Dev8 Ed in Birmingham. That's not Birmingham accent. I don't know what that was.
Right.
It was like a sort of developer conference for developers working in education, which
okay.
is cool.
And was it good? Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. Did an interview, which you'll hear more about.
Yeah, in half
later.
An hour or so.
And
a bit later.
Also went to the Southampton Beer Festival.
Are we going to hear more about that later?
No.
Okay. Was it good though?
It was very good.
Fair enough. Alan?
Hello.
Hello. What have you been doing other than making inappropriate innuendos?
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. I was referring to the sausages.
It's a family-friendly show, don't you know?
So we've recently put out 1204, so I thought it was about time to upgrade to Quantel Quetzal.
Uh-huh.
What will be 1210 on my desktop for a bit of fun.
Does it work?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it shiny?
Because there's not much difference. Yeah. Yet. It's not all changed much.
It's just a new branch.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And it works all right. Yeah.
Cool. Excellent. Laura, what have you been doing then?
I updated my blog to a new WordPress theme and thought it would be straightforward because that's what the point of CSS is, that you just flick things across and it just works. However, I've still yet to go through and make some changes to the theme to make it fit.
What did you break?
I didn't break anything as such, but I did discover a clever thing where if I've got a picture, the following paragraph isn't formatted correctly.
Ooh,
and I think it's something to do with the way WordPress, even in the rich editor, lets you, in the HTML bit, lets you do a new paragraph without a tag.
So you're going to have to go through and edit all your old posts?
That or add a bit to the CSS.
Fun.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Either way, it's going to take a few minutes.
Just a few.
Yeah.
So, Tony, what have you been up to?
Oh, let me think. We have a new router here at Studio A.
Gosh.
Yes, a new router. My ISP, who are O2, sent me an email saying, you've had your router for a while. Would you like a new one?
Have you plugged it in?
Yes.
It's just that I didn't get prompted for a password or anything.
No, we transferred those settings across. But it promised faster speeds and things. And actually, it's an 802.11n wireless router. So they sent me one of those for free, essentially.
Yep.
Of course, it hasn't actually increased the upstream bandwidth. So whilst you're connecting to the wireless router much more quickly,
I'm connected to your router at 65 megabits a second. What's your downstream bandwidth?
It's about 2 to 3, depending on the weather. Yeah, yeah. So hope you're enjoying there about the extra bandwidth.
It's got bigger LEDs on it.
Yeah,
really? Mm. Are they obnoxious blue ones?
No, they're green.
They're green.
Yeah. It's more obvious.
But yeah, so that's about being the highlight of my last 2 weeks.
Gosh, don't get too excited.
Yeah, okay, right. So let's start off the show then with our interview with Elizabeth.
We have on the line from the United States of America, Liz Crumback. Hello, Liz. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Not bad. I think we're done with the Jubilee festivities, something you don't have to worry about.
Nope, none of that over here.
So I wanted to have a chat with you about some loco-related stuff, but I just wanted to start with an introduction and find out how you got involved in Ubuntu, because you've been around the Ubuntu project for a long time. I wanted to know how you got involved and what you kind of do within the Ubuntu project.
Okay, I guess I sort of got involved first, because I was involved with Debian, doing some Debian packaging for work. And then I was trying to find another distribution to use on my laptops, which I could never get working with wireless. And then I decided to try Ubuntu, and it worked on my laptops, and it, you know, had wireless and all that. So that's really where I started. And then I found, through my work with Debian women, I found Ubuntu women and started exploring the community after joining there. So I think the first thing I was really involved with was the loco in Pennsylvania, where I was living at the time.
And when you say you're involved in Debian Women and that, you know, kick-started you into Ubuntu Women, what was and is the premise behind Ubuntu Women? Because I think a lot of people may misunderstand or not quite get why it exists and what it does.
Right. So we pretty much recruit women into using Ubuntu and contributing to Ubuntu. The project itself is made up of men and women from all around the Ubuntu community. So we pretty much find women who are interested and then pair them up with people in the community who can help them get started. So it's really about support, encouragement, and bringing more people in to contribute and use it, and giving them a comfortable environment to do that in.
And is that something that you feel is necessary because there aren't enough women, or the women that have tried haven't, you know, found it welcoming, or what's the main driver for actually trying to do this?
I think more generally, a lot of people find joining any open source project kind of intimidating. And so when you couple that with being a minority joining an open source project, it can be even harder. So there are other groups like Ubuntu Youth who try to get students involved, because there can be sometimes a bit of ageism as well in open source communities. So Ubuntu Women really just tries to target women in the community to bring them in, whereas youth targets youth and other groups like that. So it's really just building upon, you know, there's already a bit of apprehension in joining and then trying to make it more comfortable. And we work with women because, you know, personally, I want to see more women involved, and they are a very big group.
You mentioned there that Ubuntu Youth is good because there's some ageism in the community. Do you find that, generally speaking, there is still some sexism in the community that Ubuntu Women sort of needs to overcome?
I think most generally we don't encounter a lot of sexism in the Ubuntu community these days. Most of the people I work with on a day-to-day basis, I mean, they're really great. I think where we do find it is in a broader community. A lot of users assume that everyone who works on Ubuntu is male, so we'll get a lot of, you know, thanks, man, and I say, I'm not a man, but you're welcome. and so, there's little subtle things like that, and there are also other bigger things that have come up. But the Ubuntu community in general does a very good job this regard.
So, what got you involved
we do
in...
We still have things we need to get over.
What got you involved in Debian Women in the first place? Was that your personal experience or just interest?
So I had been involved in Linux Chicks for a long time, mm-hmm. So it felt like a natural progression once I started getting involved with Debian.
So one of the things that you mentioned was that it was the wider community that probably has more of an issue. Do you think this is maybe because within the community we kind of try and remind people about this code of conduct document that we have that maybe some people don't read very often, but we kind of have knowledge that it exists and, you know, a general feeling don't be horrible to people. Do you think the fact that there are plenty of people outside our community or in the wider community that don't feel the need to subscribe to that code of conduct is where that, you know, sexist or you know, non-respectful behavior comes from?
Yeah, definitely. That is part of it. There's other things, whereas in the Ubuntu community, we're pretty good about recognizing contributions of people and highlighting the work of really outstanding individuals, including a lot of women in our community. So when you're inside the community, not only do you feel like you have to abide by the code of conduct, you're also being exposed to a lot of really successful people in the community who may challenge a lot of stereotypes that people who are more on the outside don't necessarily see.
Right. So this positive reinforcement. What are the things that on the positive side does Ubuntu Women do to make Ubuntu a more welcoming and more pleasant place for people in minorities like women?
So one of the things we do is we have an informal mentoring program where we pair up women who are interested in getting involved with people in the project who can help them get where they're interested in going. We also find that role models are very important. So we'll find women in our community who are already doing really great work, and we'll interview them for Full Circle magazine, or we'll interview them for Ubuntu Fridge, or do something to get their name out there and publish the fact that they're doing really great work. So once people have role models, then it doesn't feel so weird, you know, to be entering that space as a minority.
Right.
So those are two of the main things that we work on.
Okay.
We also encourage women to contribute to the Ubuntu Classroom sessions. So for Open Week and Classroom, we always make sure we directly ask women in the project to do sessions, because they're women generally are less likely to put themselves forward for something, and when directly asked, they're more likely to contribute.
Right. Do you see any value in maybe some women-only events? I know in the UK we had a Flossie event that I think Laura went to.
Not this Laura.
Not that Laura, the other Laura Tchaikovsky. Do you see value in those kind of, you know, female-only things where, you know, there's less likelihood of, you know, other people derailing things in, if that makes sense. When I say other people, I mean the other 50%.
So I certainly see value in those kinds of gatherings and groups, but I think enough of them exist at this point that if someone wants to go to a private, you know, event or group where there's only women, there are a lot of things available. The really important thing about Ubuntu Women and Debian Women is both projects have key support from key members of the project who aren't women. And for us, having men in the channel and men who are supportive and very, you know, recognized within the Ubuntu community lends a lot of credibility and helps us a lot in our projects. So for us, having women-only events doesn't really work.
Okay. You mentioned the loco you were previously active in, and now you're based in California. I understand you're part of the California loco. Can you tell me something about what the California team does, how it's made up, whether, you know, loose-knit or tightly people? How does it all fit together?
So California is a really big state. So we've got little groups all over the state that do things. They do their own Ubuntu hours, and you don't really need permission to do them. Everyone just puts them in the Loco team portal and announces them to the mailing list, and they have their own events. So we'll have events, release parties are all around the state. We also go to a few conferences each year. The big one is the Southern California Linux Expo, which is usually in the winter. So the locals in Los Angeles there will bring a bunch of stuff, and some of us will fly down from San Francisco area and other places to staff the booth at scale, where we also run an UbuCon the day before the conference. So that's a big event we do.
What happens at an UbuCon? Sorry, what happens at an UbuCon?
Oh, right. UbuCon is a Ubuntu-specific event where we have presentations on getting involved with Ubuntu, Ubuntu in cloud, and other just Ubuntu-specific stuff from Loco team members. So it's a whole day of presentations. And then this time we went out to dinner afterwards. That was fun.
Cool. And how is the team structured? Do you have like a governance board that manages the projects that you take on, or is it pretty much free for all, everyone does what they like?
So technically we've got a leadership trio, which are just elected each year. Currently, I'm one of them, and then there's another one who's down in Fountain View, which is about 45 minutes south of me, and then we've got another guy down in San Diego, which is very far south. So we try to grab leaders from all over the state, so we're properly represented. And then, in reality, the leadership team really just makes sure we have meetings and makes sure announcements get out. No one really needs our permission to do anything, and it's pretty much everyone just does their own thing. And if there are problems, we might step in, but it hasn't really come up. So,
oh, that's good.
They're pretty casual.
How do you organize the financial side of things? I know a lot of loco teams have a real problem organizing events if they don't have any income or way of managing their income. How do you deal with that?
So we deal with it by most generally not dealing with money very much. At any given time, someone in the loco may have $100 or less that comes in from donations. Like, we had a volunteer who gave us a bunch of T-shirts once. And we said, if you want a T-shirt, you can give us a donation, and we'll use that donation to ship CDs all around the state. So for really small things like that, we've kept it, you know, it's very casual, and as long as it's a very low amount, we don't need to worry too much about it. There are things like booths at certain events, which give a nonprofit discount. So in those cases, the loco team has typically teamed up with other groups in the area, one of which may be a nonprofit who can get the nonprofit discount. So the nonprofit is actually the one who's handling the booth and handling all of the logistics, and it's their name on the booth. And then we come in as volunteers to help support them. So it really ends up being a booth that's run by the nonprofit with representatives from Ubuntu California and the Berkeley Linux Users Group and the San Francisco Group and whoever else ends up coming by.
So is this a way to work around the system so you don't have to register and go do all the paperwork and the bookkeeping and the taxes and so on?
Right, yeah. It makes it much easier all around.
And I understand this, the team that that you most closely work with is called Partimus. Can you tell me a little bit about what they do in the area?
Right, so Partimus is a nonprofit whose mission is to get open source software and other free culture into classrooms. I'm actually on the board of Partimus as well as being involved with Ubuntu California. So we take donated computers, and then we give a tax. The company donating the computers gets a tax write-off, or individuals donating. So that's really great for them, since we're a nonprofit. And then we take the computers and then we put them in local charter schools, which are, in the United States, charter schools are semi-public. They're sort of an experiment by the educational world in trying to think of different ways.
Yeah, I think we've got something similar.
Okay, yeah, good. Yeah, so they're semi-public. If they get public funding, there's a raffle. Anyone can apply to attend them, but they're pretty sought after, so it can be hard to get into them. But as far as we go, they're not bound by restrictions that normal public schools are here in the United States. There's a lot of bureaucracy around funding and what kind of software can be brought in and what kind of software is approved. So it's really complicated to get into traditional public schools.
All right.
So we work with charter schools who have a lot more funding flexibility. And we'll bring the computers in, and we'll hook them up to the network. And in most cases, these schools never had computers before.
Wow.
And so the computers run Ubuntu, and we have lots of different types of deployments. We've got labs, which are centrally managed by a server, and then we've got a project in the works that's just like 20 laptops that gets moved around to different classrooms. And those don't necessarily have to be formally networked. They just have pretty vanilla install of Ubuntu on them.
It's fascinating It's fascinating to say that there are schools who haven't had computers before. Yeah. I think even the poorest school in the most deprived area of this country, a government-funded school, has some computer presence. Is it common in America for that to be the case?
I don't know about common, but California in particular has pretty bad schools. We're some of the lowest-rated schools in the country, and there's not a lot of funding that goes to them, and particularly in the case of charter schools, since they can decide where they put the money, they rather put the money towards hiring better teachers and getting upgraded facilities, which don't necessarily include technology.
So do you think that makes Ubuntu an attractive option for them because there's a lower cost associated with it?
Not just Ubuntu, but the fact that we bring all the computers in for free. Mm. So the hardware is free to them, the software is free to them, and we also do maintenance on the networks and everything. So we're the ones running the Ethernet cable and doing all that. They usually negotiate an internet connection because in a lot of the schools, maybe a teacher or two may have a computer, but in it's just the students that don't have them. So they may have an internet connection already. So we just leverage that when we come to deploy our own systems there.
Typically, how old are the computers that you're providing to them?
I'm sorry?
How old do the computers tend to be? They're sort of three-year-old?
Or? How old? So currently the lowest spec computer we'll accept is a Pentium 4 with a gig of RAM. Mm-hmm. So we'll take anything above that. That or above.
And do you ship stock Ubuntu? Do you fiddle with it? Do you lock it down in any way? Do you, you know, what can a student expect as their experience?
So it really depends on the school. The one school where we had a pretty successful lab, we used an imaging server that would image all the computers, and it would set a default administrative account and a default student account that was all managed through OpenLDAP. So that was the student account was pretty locked down, doesn't have administrative functions, the GNOME panel is locked and all that kind of stuff. So they can't really mess it up a lot. And then the administrative account can pretty much do anything. Beyond that, we also had classrooms where we really would just install default Ubuntu and put on a pretty background or something that's applicable to the school.
Cool.
And then do things like we'd install Flash or install Java and tune it up so they could use the Java applications that they might be using.
Right.
But it really depends on the school and what their needs are and what their infrastructure looks like.
And do you get any feedback from the students? Are they happy with this experience? Do they say, oh, no, it's not Windows? Or, you know, do they actually use them?
Yeah, so most people who are using them, they think it's fine. The kids are very, the ones we're targeting, elementary and middle school, they can adapt new interfaces faster than the teachers can. So they don't care what they're using. And a lot of the applications they're using at this point are Flash and Java-based, and they're web apps.
Right.
So they fire up Firefox, which they would do at home, if they have a computer at home. And it's just a web browser, so it doesn't really matter a whole lot.
Brilliant. So if anyone wants to find out more about Parsimus, the work you do, and the school's projects, where can they find out more?
The website is just parsimus.org, and that'll have links to the projects we're working on and information about the project, and as well as a link to our blog, which is where we really update most of.
And people can donate as well to finance your work.
Yep.
Fantastic.
Right. And we have our federal tax ID number on the website. So if anyone in the U.S. is donating, they can get a tax exemption for their donation.
Fantastic.
Yeah, even better.
It's been lovely to speak to you, Liz. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks.
Cheers. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
It's time for some news.
It's that time again. Humble Bundle V, or 5, is now available, containing 4 games and a bonus 5th if you pay over the average price. For the first time, it's also available to install via the Ubuntu Software Center.
Yes, it is.
All of them.
Of course I bought it, yes, like I have every other Humble Bundle.
Have you played it?
I've played some of them. I haven't played all of them because some of them require decent 3D card and my laptop only has a little Intel thing. But Limbo's really good. It's really nice little
yes,
game.
I just played it. It's good fun.
It is, yeah. And being in the software center is quite good.
Yes, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, so you can add them to all your machines if you want to.
Can you pay, can you pick your own price if you're buying it through the software center?
No, you buy, well, not in this version. I think we don't have that facility yet. So you still go to the humblebundle.com and you go through the normal buying process where you allocate how much money you want to go to the developers and the charities and so on. And then after you've paid, you then see a button that says Software Center, and it takes you to a web page with links to installing all the games.
It's cool.
Mm. Cool.
Well, it's not quite all the games. One of the games isn't in the repository yet because it's huge. That made some trouble there.
Fair enough.
The judge in the case of Oracle versus Google has ruled that APIs cannot be copyrighted.
Hooray!
This is good news, isn't it?
It's very good news.
And all claims of copyright infringement against Google for its use of the Java API have been dismissed.
This is fantastic news, but Mark, tell us why.
Well, basically, if APIs were copyrightable, then if you wanted to make... Well, for a start, it would mean that things that Google did where you do like a clean room implementation of an API that already exists so you can write your own software without having to license the original stack it runs on top of, you wouldn't be able to do that. But it would also mean that you'd require a license to write a plugin for a system with an API, which would basically just completely destroy a lot of software ecosystems.
Excellent that they have sorted that out. Well, sort of. Mozilla has announced that it will resume producing Firefox mobile builds for the ARMv6 processors found in lower-end smartphones.
Interesting.
Mm. Does mine count as lower-end?
Yes.
Yours is very
as does mine. Yours is the predecessor to mine, and mine has this processor, which they're talking about.
This is the same processor era or revision that's in the Raspberry Pi.
Ah. Yeah.
And interestingly, one of the reasons that they said they're looking at it is because basically most of the phones that are sold in China and other emerging markets have these processors.
Right.
And so if they want to really, really expand with the mobile browser, then they need to support that those phones.
So it's the iPhone 3 era of CPU. It's that kind of spec that a lot of these phones are.
I don't know a lot about iPhones.
No, the iPhone 3 has the same kind of spec as the Raspberry Pi. So it's
Really?
Similar.
Wow.
Yeah.
Law firm Berman de Valerio has filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of Facebook's shareholders with the accusation that it misled the market as to the company's value in its recent flotation. Launching at $39 per share in mid-May, the company's stock has fallen to around $27 per share.
Mm. And there's allegedly some naughty things that they did. Which artificially inflated the price.
Quite naughty.
Or at least stopped it dropping.
Don't you think Facebook would be able to hire a vast swathe of lawyers that prove that they didn't do this thing?
Well, I think this particular law firm has been successful. I can't remember which company it was against, but it was another big company who had a similar situation before and they were successful.
And what's the outcome? Is it just you pay some remediation to the participants of the... of the class action lawsuit,
Basically, if
it's not going to reverse the IPO or anything stupid like that.
No, I think if they rule in their favour, then anyone who was affected can basically say, "Yeah, me too," and they can claim some compensation back from Facebook. I think that's the way it works.
So all that money that Facebook is now not worth, they have to pay to somebody else,
essentially.
I also saw an article where some leading analyst was saying Facebook will be gone in 5 to 8 years' time. Which, given what's happened to things
MySpace,
Bebo, Orkut, and the
social
buzz
diaspora,
wave,
it's inevitable, really. Whether that 5 to 8 years is accurate or not is,
five to 8 years is a very long time in the internet.
Yes, we've been doing this 5 years,
It's a very long time.
Some of us have. The Flame malware targeting Windows computers has been found to be able to propagate between computers by making itself appear as signed Windows software and installing through Windows Update. Microsoft has since released an update to mark the certificates used as untrusted.
Oops.
Ooh. Yes, pretty bad when you can make your malware appear to be signed by Microsoft.
Yeah, so it wasn't actually signed by Microsoft, but
it appeared to be.
Like it looked like it was.
Yes.
So they've revoked the certificates that appeared to have been signed by.
I think they've blacklisted the authorities which the certificates were reporting to be signed by.
Right.
If you understand cryptography and SSL and SSL, is that what I'm after?
Mm. Yeah, maybe. Yes.
Then this will make a lot of sense. Otherwise, it probably won't.
Okay. Thanks for taking part.
The internet's Brian Lunduk has kicked off a campaign to open source his own code if he receives enough donations and subscriptions. Brian started the scheme last Monday with a deadline this week, which has already been extended as the target of $4,000 has not yet been reached. It's an interesting proposition.
So what's the software?
So he's made a bunch of software. There's a couple of games. There's an app developer environment, like a graphical app developer creation kit thing. There's a comic reader and a couple of other things as well. Yeah, he's asked for a subscription of $4,000 per month. Not one person to pay that. Yeah. A number of people.
Enough people to...
Yeah, collectively.
Because
yeah.
this is, at the moment, it's basically his business, how he makes his money.
Yeah.
So he sells the software.
So he's asking for people to subscribe a certain amount every month, totaling $4,000, for him to continue to work on the software, but to release it as to open
continue
source.
Continue working on that software. And I don't know if he mentioned all new software as well, but at the moment it's existing software.
It's an interesting model.
It is.
Because even once you've started it, what's to stop people cancelling their subscriptions?
Yeah, and the code's already out.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting that the code that his stuff is written in is real basic, which is non-free in itself. So the or at least some of it is written in real basic. So even if it were open source, there's no way that most distros could actually ship binary packages because they don't have the build tools to build the software. So how useful this would be, you know, if it was written in C or C++ or Python, it might be more useful, arguably, than it currently is. But it's worth watching and see if this succeeds and whether other people might be able to make a go of this as well.
Certainly hasn't got off to the best start if he's extended his
Maybe he was over-optimistic.
Perhaps. And it was an arbitrary date, he said. I think it was $3,500 he got to in a week.
Oh, well.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's not far
off. That's not bad, is it?
But that... You know, that needs to be maintained.
Yes.
Because that's only 1 month of his rent, you know. So.
Yeah. Fair enough.
And events?
There is only one event.
Literally.
Only one event
here.
That's worth knowing about. Og Camp. That's Og Camp. Is happening...
When is it?
It's in August.
The 17th, 18th, 19th. That weekend, isn't
that
it?
That weekend.
Yes. So it's what? 10 weeks away?
Something like that, yes.
Ooh, don't say it like that.
Good maths.
Yeah, and it's in Liverpool, and we've told you all the details before, and you can find more details at ogcamp.org. But we've got some exciting updates to update you with this
week.
Have we,
Mark?
We do.
Excite me.
As with last year, we're going to have several tracks. So one of the tracks on the main stage is going to be scheduled, and the other tracks are going to be open for everyone to come and give their talks. On the day, or as they wish,
in a sort of bar camp style,
exactly
similar to last year. That bit, isn't it? Mm.
And we have the first few speakers confirmed for our scheduled track.
Oh, go on, tell us who it is, Mark.
We have Alex Martindale.
Do you need a drum roll?
Too late for that.
Have we licensed
that?
Do you
have a drum roll queued up? We have Alex Martindale, who is going to be talking about the history of errors, I believe, was the title of his talk.
Cool. Sounds interesting.
We have another drum roll, please, Maestro.
Oh, you want one for everybody? Okay.
Sorry, is that going to reach out too much time?
It's really loud.
We have Alan O'Donoghue, who organised Hack to the Future.
Cool.
I won't bother with more drum rolls. We have Ross Gardler, who...
Oh, poor Ross. Didn't get a drum roll.
Give him a drum roll.
Oh, no. And what's he going to talk about?
Drums?
In true bar camp style, he's going to decide closer to the event.
Okay.
He is on the board of the Apache Software Foundation.
Oh.
And does quite a lot of community stuff like that. He's a good speaker.
Yeah.
And finally...
Is that your way of saying another drum roll?
Yeah, please.
Well-oiled machine here.
We have Lindsay Anison, who's going to be talking about the Broadband for the Rural North project.
Ooh, that sounds interesting.
Yes,
it is. Because we're going to the Rural North, aren't we, for Og Camp this year?
What, Liverpool?
That's really rural.
It's in the north.
It's not quite north.
It's all fields up there.
It's north.
So, yeah, the details about them and their talks and when they're going to be talking will be on the website. And we will announce other speakers in future weeks.
I think I still need to book a hotel.
Yeah, don't forget to book the hotel. The details are on the website.
Yeah, it's getting booked up.
You've got to call Janice between the hours of half 10 and half 11 on a Monday.
No, you don't. You just phone up and tell them and it's fine.
It's the phoning part.
Yeah. Let's sort that out and then we can see you there.
You just phone someone in America for an interview who you've never met before. Why can't you just phone someone in Liverpool?
I don't like talking on phones.
Okay.
Right, okay. And we'll see you at Og Camp, hopefully.
If we book.
And now the triumphant return of Command Line Love.
Hurrah.
Good stuff.
So what are we loving this week?
So it's a very simple command. It's R Madison. R-M-A-D-I-S-O-N.
Who's he?
Okay.
And the reason I discovered this is that I was asking our good friend and ex-colleague Dave to...
Dave Walker, Dave?
Yes.
Oh, right.
I asked him for some help getting a package into the repository and in Ubuntu. And he, rather than, when I asked the question, is it in the repository, rather than tell me the answer, yes or no, he echoed the output of a command at me, which is good.
Slash exec O.
Well, no, he was teaching a man how to fish rather than giving me the fish itself, which I would much prefer.
And then telling you effectively to fish off.
Well, I've now got content for the show, so it's a double whammy of excellence. So R Madison, you just type R Madison and then a space and then a package name. So, for example, R Madison space Firefox, and it will tell you what releases of Ubuntu has that package and the version number of that package and what architectures it's available in and which part of the repository is in. So if you ever wanted to know, oh, well, what version of Firefox is in Lucid and is it, you know, Universe, is it in main or is it, you know, is it compiled for ARM or not? You just run R Madison Firefox and you get a whole load of output that tells you exactly what versions of the package are in where. It's really cool.
And who controls which repositories it looks at for that information? Is it just the ones that are available on your system at the time?
I think it queries your... I don't know. Is it short? Okay. I was going to guess, but I'm not going to.
Okay.
But you, I think you can override all of that kind of stuff. There's loads of command line options. You can give it a URL to go to. So you could tell it to go to the Debian repository, or you could tell it to go to a, you know, some...
Other place
on other the internet. Than the default, but the default seems to be there's probably a config file in etc somewhere, but yeah, it works.
Cool, excellent. Well, thank you for that command line love.
That's all right.
I'm here at Dev 8 Ed with Dr. Chuck Severance. Good evening, Dr. Chuck. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Mark. Brilliant. Great to be here.
You enjoying the event so far?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Brilliant. Now, Chuck, you're a man of many hats, one might say. You've done a lot of things. You've got a lot of roles in a lot of places. One of the things you're probably best known for is your work with Sakai.
Right.
And you've written a book about the Sakai project. So some of our listeners might not know what Sakai is. So do you just want to start by telling us a bit about what Sakai is and how it came to be?
Sure. Sakai is an open source learning management system like Blackboard Learn or Moodle. Mm-hmm. The formation of Sakai was a little different than any other open source in that Sakai was funded in 2004 from the Mellon Foundation with a grant to bring four universities together to build in a team way a single learning management system for themselves.
Right.
And so the Mellon Foundation, in effect, created a family, and we really functioned very much like a family, which means we agreed on some things, we disagreed on other things, and we had to get through. And so it was like a marriage. It was an open source project and known to be open source, but we'd all agreed that whatever we collectively produced, we would all use.
Right.
And so that is a little different than most open source that starts by one or two individuals who make something and then they open source it and then a community grows around it. We basically started with a very specific goal in mind and we had to achieve that goal according to the grant.
Yeah.
So we were under a little more pressure and in a little more of a hurry than most open source projects when they're getting started.
Yeah. So what was your role in this family to begin with?
So I was the chief architect, which meant that... a whole bunch of developers reported to me, and then I reported to a board, an advisory board of directors.
Uh-huh.
And so I was where things like the buck stopped here.
Yeah.
I was the one that said no.
Mm-hmm.
I was the one that said yes. I was the one that made lots of final decisions on the technical and feature directions for the project. And so I did that. I kept making lots of decisions, and I... tended not to want a slipped project, and I wanted to meet our deadlines, and it was actually quite stressful. That's the reason that I wrote a book about it. I wrote a book because it was kind of like nobody, no school, not MIT, not Stanford, not Indiana, not Michigan. No school wanted to be seen as not holding up their end of the bargain.
Right.
And we'd made an on-paper commitment, and so it was like the pressure was on, but there was very little degrees of freedom. But mm-hmm. I think something amazing cool. with that much pressure.
So I suppose no product is ever finished, but from what came out of the project and your involvement in it, what does it have that would make an institution use it over some of the competing products that are already out there?
Right. So it's kind of like, what are the advantages that Sakai has? So I might start with some of the disadvantages of uh-huh. Sakai. Until very recently, Sakai was missing what you'd think of as a structured content feature that mm-hmm. Moodle would call activities, Blackboard would call content, and we just finally got that in 2012.
Right.
And that's 8 years later. But finally, the Sakai 2.9 release is what to me was its greatest weakness, has finally been addressed in the version that we're working on and should be releasing. So that's the weakness. Thankfully, it's addressed in our next release that puts Sakai nicely on par with most of the mainstream features that other learning management systems have. But you say, okay, here's this learning management system, and it's not necessarily the technically best or the best set of features. Why do people like Sakai? What kind of schools like Sakai? And I would say that the profile of the schools that choose Sakai are schools that want to really control their own destiny, schools that have an agenda for their learning management system. Some schools just want to download something or to buy something, plug it in, turn it on, watch the database, hope that they have enough hardware, and get through a semester, then get through another semester, and then maybe upgrade over the summer, and complain to their vendor that they don't have features that they don't like. That is not how a Sakai school works.
Uh-huh.
A Sakai school says, my learning management system is essential and strategic, and I'm going to play with it. I'm going to listen to my faculty. I'm going to add things. I'm going to take things out. I'm going to change its look and feel. And we have a way of thinking at University of X, and we want Sakai to look this way. And, oh, by the way, we don't want to not be able to upgrade. We want to be able to tweak Sakai in a myriad of ways and then still be able to upgrade. And so Sakai was really written by people at some of the top 50 universities in the world, and they're all kind of hackers.
Right.
So they built collectively the most hackable learning management system on the planet. And so that's what people love about Sakai, is the fact that you can bend it and morph it and turn it anywhere from a research group support tool to a teaching and learning tool to a distance education tool by like plugging and tweaking and shoving and bending. And so it's just kind of like this silly putty kind of a piece of software. And when people download Sakai, they see that it has like, I don't know, 1,000 options. And mm-hmm. they go, oh, this is terrible. Well, then we put 1,000 little switches in because some schools want to do it this way, some schools want to do it that way. Okay, we'll put a switch in. Here's another problem. Oh, some schools want to. So we have 1,000 switches. And that's because we don't want people modifying the code if they can at all help it, when they have all this flexibility and all this dynamic stuff that they want to do. We want to make it so that they can keep upgrading and share the code. And so it was, again, very different than most open source things where there's one or two individuals that are like the visionary of it all, and that flows out through the product. It's really a very much collective thing of these top 50 schools.
Now, Sakai is obviously something that you're very passionate about.
I am.
And you're actually quite a remarkable person in your field, in that you've actually got it tattooed on your arm.
I do, sitting right here. Now, there it is.
The thing is that it's not the only tattoo on your arm. So,
nope.
Do you just want to tell me about the tattoos and what the significance is?
Sure. So the center of the tattoo is Sakai.
Yep.
Because that's the center of my universe. That's kind of where it all comes from. Mm-hmm. That's where it's all born. Directly above the Sakai is the logo of the IMS Global Learning Consortium,
right?
Which is the standards organization that builds interoperability standards like question test interoperability, QTI, IMS Common Cartridge, IMS Learning Tools interoperability. And so it's sort of like I went from Sakai In 2007, I resigned in Sakai. That, of course, is in the book. And I started working from 2008 till the present at IMS, and so I put this IMS logo on. Mm-hmm. Then the rest of the logos are the first eight vendors that complied to the IMS Learning Tools interoperability specification. So that includes Blackboard, Desire to Learn, Genzibar, Instructure, Moodle, Learning Objects, and OLAD. So as each one of those learning management systems was certified by Learning Tools Interoperability, then I would get a tattoo of all of them. And there's one blank space left for the next one to get certified.
So why do you think that something like Learning Tools Interoperability is such an important thing to have that you would get tattoos on your arm?
Well, the simple answer is that Learning Tools Interoperability is going to change everything.
Mm-hmm.
It is going to change everything about teaching and learning. Historically, from essentially 1997 till 2010, 2011, if you wanted a learning tool, you simply had to wait until your vendor provided it for you.
Right.
You maybe could add an extension or whatever, but you just were at the mercy of the provider of your learning management system. And the providers of learning management systems, whether it's Moodle or Blackboard or Sakai or anybody, they have to balance priorities. They're not going to put every feature in.
Mm-hmm.
If they put every feature in, the thing gets too big and it explodes. And so an individual school or an individual faculty member often has something they want, and they just can't have it. Learning Tools Interoperability makes it so you can build capabilities outside in cloud-hosted or locally hosted. You can build a tool outside the learning management system and then trivially plug it in. But what's cool about it is all these learning management systems have plugins, but they don't have a standard plugin.
Yeah.
Tools Interoperability is the standard plugin. So there's innovative products. Piazza is a good example of a really cool threaded discussion that a lot of faculty members really love.
Mm-hmm.
Piazza is a little tiny startup company. They started making this cool threaded discussion, and it uses Tools Interoperability, and so it doesn't matter. They could walk into a Moodle school and plug it in. They can walk into a Desire to Learn school, they plug it in. They walk into a Blackboard Learn school, they plug it in. On and on and on and on. And so what this does is it's the beginning of what I think of like an app store for education, where
right.
a teacher, much like we do on our mobile phones, just like, you know, I'd like one of those. And then like minutes later, you have one of those,
yeah.
as compared to, I'd like one of those, and then a year later, maybe you have it or maybe you don't have it. And so it means that the innovation, pace of innovation is far more rapid, and there's the creation of a market for someone who can build a tiny, small tool extension and then make money on that without having to build an entire learning management system and then compete straight up with Blackboard, Desire to Learn, Sakai, or Moodle.
Cool. Now, you mentioned there about one of your career moves in the past. Now, in the over the past year, you took what some might have considered a slightly unexpected career move in that you started working for Blackboard, who not only compete with Sakai, but are viewed by some historically as sort of the bad guys of the VLE ecosystem. There's been some, you know, patent infringement cases in the past and so on. So how did that come about, and what are you now doing at Blackboard?
So, yeah, that seems like an illogical step, but for people who know me, it's actually quite a logical step. I don't believe that open source is the natural enemy of proprietary software. If you look at the relationship between IBM and Linux, or the relationship between IBM and Apache web server, you see situations where IBM is making lots and lots of money off of Linux.
Yeah.
IBM is making lots and lots of money off the Apache web server. And IBM is giving back to the open source in a healthy way. And certainly in 2005, 2006, Blackboard was pursuing an aggressive win-lose strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And we in Sakai found ourselves on kind of the receiving end of that win-lose strategy when the patent, Sakai was never sued for the patent, but we were afraid that we were
right.
going to get sued. And so we spent a lot of energy sort of fighting to protect ourselves from the thing that we thought could happen any day. And that resolved itself for Sakai in February 2007 when Blackboard issued what I think may be unprecedented, which was a grant of immunity to that patent to any piece of open source software. commercial or otherwise. Sakai didn't ask for an exemption for itself, yeah. nor did Moodle ask for an exemption for itself. We asked an exemption that was much broader, any open source, commercial or otherwise. And so Blackboard gave us that immunity from that patent, as well as Moodle, A-Tutor, OLAT, and any other open source product that comes along. And during that time, Blackboard bought WebCT, then they bought Angel, and yeah, Blackboard seemed like the heavy in the marketplace. And so what's changed? So I would say kind of at some level, Blackboard probably learned from the mistakes that they made. Mm-hmm. The patent attack didn't work out so well. Let's hope that Blackboard is smart enough to learn from its mistakes. Mm-hmm. But really for Blackboard, it was a pursuit of standards and interoperability as a general strategy that started when Ray Henderson was hired. But the other thing that was sort of happening inside of Blackboard was the notion of purchasing companies and then trying to assimilate them seemed like it wasn't such a great strategy after all. And so the idea that kind of grew inside Blackboard, I wasn't part of these discussions, but it was really evidenced by the March 26th announcement, was the next time they purchase somebody or some company or some product, that don't try to assimilate them. Let them continue to operate independently. Mm-hmm. And so on March 26th, Blackboard purchased Moodle Rooms, which is the world's largest Moodle provider, NetSpot, which I think is the world's second largest provider out of Australia, decided to, instead of trying to merge all the Angel features into the Learn product, it's decided to continue the Angel product for the Angel customers, mm-hmm. Extend its life. And they had a learning management system called Edline, which is very popular in K-12. And then they wanted Sakai, and they wanted to come up with this 5 learning management system strategy. And they wanted to make it so that after they purchased Moodle Rooms, that they would continue to function inside the Moodle community the same way they had before, in a respectful way, contributing in a positive way, supporting Martin Dugiamas. And then they wanted to do the same thing with Sakai. And the Sakai community towards the end of last year was kind of starting to run out of resources.
Right.
And I was getting kind of frustrated. And I wanted to work on Sakai, and nobody would pay me to work on Sakai, and I couldn't find any friends to work on Sakai that I could convince to work on Sakai without me paying them. And as Blackboard was coming up with this sort of more inclusive multi-learning management system strategy, I ended up in a conversation. It actually started with a tweet on February 15th, where I was really frustrated, and I said, I'm sick and tired of all this. I just want someone else to raise money and give me the money, and then they can take credit for all the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And I got a text from a 202 area code at that point, and the text said, you will soon work for me. And 202, of course, is Washington, D.C. in the United right. States of America. And at that point, I could have said no, but I was getting what I wanted. I wanted to be able to work on Sakai. I wanted to be able to invest in Sakai. I wanted to make Sakai better. And having Blackboard become sort of a commercially involved in Sakai was just icing on the cake. And placing Sakai in this 5 LMS strategy that included Blackboard Learn, Angel, which I love Angel, Moodle, and Sakai, and this Edline. And it's like, wow, this is a great team, right? I love the notion of stabilizing the learning management system marketplace by having these 5 learning management systems coordinate. So all the hoping and praying and begging I had done in previous years to get tools interoperability into 1 or 2 learning management systems, now we have one vendor that can put learning tools interoperability in 5 of them just by waving their hand and go, poof, they're going to all have it. And frankly, a school can have 2 learning management systems. I don't care. A school can not switch. A school can keep their old one as long as they want, because the new tools are going to be outside the learning management system. And so me becoming involved in Blackboard was both to save my precious Sakai,
yeah,
move it forward, but also then move the whole marketplace forward. And that's what, you know, I hope in a year or two we will look back and say, yep, things are different. There are ways that people are making money. There are innovations that are happening, and it's really cool.
Right. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. But is there somewhere that people could go to find out more about Sakai and about LTI?
Certainly you can go to the sakaiproject.org for mm-hmm. Sakai. The site to learn more about learning tools interoperability is www.imsglobal.org.
Cool. Brilliant. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay. Cheers.
It's time for the bit about Ubuntu.
Yep. Yes, yes it is.
And we start with news that Canonical, my employer, are debuting at Computex in Taipei.
What's that?
It's a massive trade show, like the biggest one in Asia.
Cool.
So everyone who's anyone is there, and we're there.
What is being...
we aren't there. No, we're here.
Well, yes.
What is being debuted?
So on the first day, I think the Ubuntu for Android, the Converge device, we call it. The Ubuntu for Android is going to be demoed at a media gathering. Mm. And Mark Shuttle is giving a keynote presentation as well. And I think Ubuntu TV is going to be there, because I know Will Cook, ooh, who works on Ubuntu TV, is out there. And I've seen a photo he's taken where there's the Ubuntu TV in the, what do they call it, the booth.
Okay, yeah.
Excellent. He's all set up, so they're showing that off as well.
Mm. Mm. So, interesting.
Mm.
Progress.
Yes.
Interesting stuff. Want to see Ubuntu TV?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you can check the code out and play with it yourself.
Yeah, I don't want to see it that much.
Is Ubuntu TV kind of like Myth TV, or is it something that's part of the hardware?
So the long-term goal is it'll be baked in a telly. You walk into a shop, okay, buy a telly, and it'll have Ubuntu TV in the telly. And there'll be lots of different tellies from lots of different manufacturers, all with the same Ubuntu TV, and it's all
Canonical it's all takes good. Over the world.
Yes. One TV at a time.
Cool.
Excellent. Okay. David Wonderly has clarified the position on Kubuntu.
Yes.
This is in terms of the use of the name Kubuntu by the Kubuntu project, yeah, since it has been harshly jettisoned by the evil overlords at Canonical.
The post is quite interesting in that it actually clarifies exactly what has changed Canonical wise.
Yeah.
It is actually still sponsored by Canonical, in that Canonical still provide them with a lot of the infrastructure.
Hosting.
Hosting and build machines and all sorts of stuff like that.
And trademarks, well.
Yes, and the Kubuntu trademark, which is quite a big one.
A lot of people have been, you know, saying, oh, well, that's not really very much. You know, anyone can host a couple of ISOs on a website. But there's an awful lot more to it than that. The build farm that builds all the packages for KDE and Ubuntu and LXDE and Ubuntu. There's a fair amount of stuff going on there, and sysadmins who are paid to look after this stuff. So, yeah, there's a fair amount of stuff. And it's good that David's blogged about it to, you know, clarify exactly what the position is and,
yes.
Who looks after which bit?
I get the impression there had been concerns that they might need to change the name of the project if there were problems in that relationship between Canonical and
Blue Systems,
or the people who, you know, the wider Kubuntu community, but it doesn't look like that'll be the case. No, so that's all right.
I think that's a problem.
Cool. Next up.
The Ubuntu Vancouver Loco team members have written a getting started guide for Ubuntu Unity.
Yes, in the form of a PDF.
Yes, it's quite... it was an old one that they've sort of decided was very out of date, so they redid it. Is that correct?
Yeah, they've updated. They'd written one for 11.04, I think, and they've updated it for 12.04. It's not huge, but it's a, you know, it's a getting started guide.
I like the idea of it simplifying your life.
Yes,
it's the sort of subtitle.
Yeah,
hopefully it will.
Alan isn't the only one foolish enough to be playing with ButterFS on Ubuntu.
Oh, who else has joined this club then?
So George Castro also has an HP micro server, and I mentioned
that he doesn't want.
that he also wants to lose data in.
Yes.
And I was chatting to him about it at UDS, and I mentioned that I was using ButterFS on mine and how I loved it. And he said, yeah, I'm going to give that a go, because he's been having problems with software MD RAID.
Right.
And it just got annoying enough that he decided to try ButterFS. And that's got to be pretty annoying if you'd want to try out an experimental file system with your data.
Yeah, so there was a great post on the kernel or the ButterFS mailing list. Somebody who shifted loads of data onto ButterFS.
That was 5 terabytes, wasn't it?
And then it seemed to be working, so then he deleted all his backups.
No.
And then it went wrong.
Then it broke.
It's easy to laugh at other people's misfortune, so let's do that for a while.
Yeah. Feel better about your own.
Feel a whole show of that.
Yeah. And finally, in the bit about Ubuntu.
PC World have an article about Ubuntu OS for smartphones may come as soon as next year.
Ooh, this isn't the converged device. This is actually Ubuntu
phones.
Yeah, as opposed to iOS or Android or...
As opposed to Android with
those.
Yeah. So the thing that's been shown off that you've seen the videos of and you've made videos of is a phone that is running Android but has Ubuntu on top, so you can use it as both a phone and a desktop computer and all that. This article is speculating about whether there will be an Ubuntu smartphone next year. Yeah, interesting.
Interesting. Watch this speculation.
Yes.
Okay. And
finally, in the not about Ubuntu, the Fedora project has announced that it will be paying to have their distribution signed by the Microsoft Evil Empire keys, making it bootable on systems with restricted UEFI bootloaders, which is required by the Windows 8 certification. And speaking for Fedora, Matthew Garrett, everyone's favorite angry man, said it's not an attractive solution, but it is a workable one.
So this is opposed to getting people to turn off UEFI protection in their BIOS, because
can
that
you
would
do
be
this?
Too.
You can. Yeah. The Windows certification thing has said that if you want it certified to run on ARM, you can't let people disable the secure boot. Yeah. But on x86, they didn't say that. So yeah,
which is interesting, given on ARM you don't really have a BIOS. So you wouldn't be, you know, I'm not sure how they would implement that. But so Fedora looking into a way of complying with this.
So it'll mean that Fedora could boot without people having to poke around and monkey around
exactly
on a Windows 8 certified machine.
Yeah. That, I mean,
but
that's
only
the goal.
For as long as Microsoft say it's okay.
So the goal is you want to be able to get a Fedora CD and boot off it and install on your machine that came with Windows 8 and had this certified platform.
Yeah.
If that's your goal, then that's what they want to achieve.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it makes sense. And I'm sure, I don't know, but I'm sure other distros such as ourselves and others are looking at ways to do this as well.
Mm. Yeah, so it's going to have to hit all distribution people, distribution manufacturers.
Yeah.
Surely at some point it becomes an EU point of interest.
Or competition.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
You'd like to hope so.
Yes, you would.
You said about them not doing the kind of you're not allowed to turn it off thing on x86. I wonder whether that's to try and get them out of any problems with that.
Potentially. But then isn't it up to the BIOS vendor, the hardware vendor, as to whether they actually implement
to sell, you don't have to be certified to sell a machine with Windows on it. It doesn't have to be certified hardware, but
then that
certain
regresses.
People won't buy
Machines that aren't certified.
Exactly, and it regresses back to the, you know, you having to go and look up machines in hardware compatibility lists and buying bits and pieces that you know are compatible that don't have this on, like individual motherboards from like eBuyer or something, and building your own machine rather than just walking into a shop and buying a machine that you know it will work on, because
it's going to make buying laptops a nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, watch this space, really.
Okay, so that's the end of the bit about and not about Ubuntu, and we will now tune in to an edition from the archives of Tomorrow's Technology Today.
Hello, and welcome to Tomorrow's Technology Today. I'm Douglas Austin Cambridge. Good day to all our listeners, wherever you are around the British Empire. It's good day to my delightful co-host, Miss Deirdre Morris Oxford.
Good day, Douglas. With what are we going to begin today?
Well, Deirdre, there's a revolutionary device for water divining below ground level using an ingenious system of magnets. We invited the inventor, Mr. Bertram Flimsy, to tell us about his invention. But he refused to talk to us.
He refused to talk to you, Douglas.
Well.
Why is that?
He used to be my old housemaster at school.
Why specifically won't he talk to you?
Ah. I set fire to his trousers in third form.
Genius.
Thank you, Deirdre. What do you have for us?
The latest prediction from the Natural History Museum in London is that its scientists will soon be able to recreate long-extinct species from deceased bone matter.
Why then, let's go over to our correspondent, Telemachus Whitby Standish, at Regent's Park Zoo, where I believe he is in the lion enclosure.
Oh dear.
It appears we cannot bring you Mr. Whitby Standish's report at this time. We do apologise.
Perhaps we can use that scientific technique to recreate the extinct Telemachus Whitby Standish, Douglas. Why is that funny, Douglas?
Yes, we've been told to put more humour into the show, Deirdre.
I would have thought one standing joke was enough, Douglas.
That's all from Tomorrow's Technology Today. Toodle-pip and God save the king. Really, Deirdre.
Oh, well, thank you very much indeed for that.
I love her. She's great.
Guffawing all over the studio. And I thought I had
those
heard...
sausages again.
Yeah. I thought I had heard the line, let's go over to our correspondent for the last time this weekend after all of the TV coverage of the Jubilee stuff.
Oh, here we go.
But, I said,
but no one's
happened.
Mentioned the Queen. Oh,
nearly made it through to the end there, Laura. That's good. We need to get mentions in because I want to put a Jubilee-related title for the show.
There you go.
So, right.
We need to talk about the Queen and the fact that it was a Diamond Jubilee. Right. That was fun. Right. Have you got anything else to say?
No, keep digging. There's more barbecue left.
There isn't. No, we've eaten the whole thing. You did. Thanks for that. That is all for this episode, however, so thank you for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website. If you go to the website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, it's got our voicemail numbers up there and Twitter feeds and Google Plus and Facebook and all these sort of things and IRC channel. And you can send us feedback. And then if you send us feedback about the show or Ubuntu or the community around it, what we might do is read it out on the show. Or if you send us a voicemail,
we'll never change anything.
We can play it out on the show. And then you get a little bit of reflected glory.
He's ad-libbing now, isn't
we
he?
We did get one feedback this show from someone called David.
Oh, yes, that's right.
He thinks I sound like Rose Tyler. I'm guessing he's not
English.
Are you
talking about the same Rose Tyler?
I think so.
Are we talking about Doctor Who?
I think so.
Rose Tyler being the blonde one, what's her
with
name?
The Cockney
Billy Piper.
Billy Piper. Yeah.
The one who doesn't have a northern
East End accent.
Right. Yes, well, you know, that's good.
But any other feedback you can send us? The ridicule? Yes.
Yeah, maybe that's
you could
what
suggest someone Alan might sound like. We all know who he looks like.
Uh-huh. Oh, dear. Right. Yeah, but we'll be back in 2 weeks on Tuesday the 19th of June for our next live episode. So you can join us then. And we may or may not have a barbecue before that one. Depends on the weather.
Definitely no Jubilees.
Definitely no Jubilees. Yeah. Or Queens. Or maybe Diamonds.
60 years of achievements compared with our 5.
Yes. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.